Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I don't have any comments today, but that's okay because I know they're coming. Well, over the last several programs, we have begun working through Chapter 7, which is titled 1917, The Uncrowned King of Arabia. Now, as I explained in an earlier program, to fully grasp this chapter, you have to understand that Lawrence's success at Aqaba had already taken place, and that's Chapter 2. We read that, you know, a long time ago. And we also have to understand that the Arab revolt against the Turks had already begun. Now, this chapter is really critically important for all of us to understand because it clearly shows that the problems of today's Middle East are beyond man's ability to solve. You know, we can send people to the moon, we can create the most fantastic computers, we can create the most fantastic job-saving or effort-saving machines, but we can't solve the problems we have among nations. It's just really sad. And the reason this is because human nature or the nature of man is tragically flawed. And to really solve the problems of today's Middle East, man's nature is going to have to be radically changed before we can fix what's wrong with the Middle East. Now today, and most likely with our next program too, let's look at the challenges that the British and Lawrence faced to bring peace to the Middle East in World War I. So we're going to go back in time, and there was a real effort to bring peace to the Middle East. But we also have to recognize that some of the difficulties with bringing peace to the Middle East were actually caused by the British. And if you look at the Middle East today, I think there are a lot of people that still want to point the finger at how Britain handled the Middle East in World War I. But you have to also remember the Arabs had their part. The French had a part in it as well. Now, if you remember back to our last program, I did mention that Allenby was shocked by Lawrence's plan to attack the Turkish railways. But eventually he began to see an advantage to it. And we have to remember that Lawrence really was a great military strategist. And he was, again, very young at the time. But still, he had studied, you know, a lot of the old battles. He had studied how to be a hero. He had studied war. And so he had a lot of history on his side. Now, the thing is, what we have to understand is even the acceptance of, let's say, Lawrence's strategy, actually inside this strategy or inside the acceptance of the strategy lay one of the major challenges in the Middle East at that time. And here's what I mean by that. If you look at Lawrence's strategy, and remember, he had his own plan for the Middle East, but he didn't tell his superiors. Well, when Allenby got a hold of his strategy to take the Turkish railways, he began to see an advantage in it, but he didn't tell Lawrence everything he was thinking as well. And so if you look at what the British had done, if you look at what the French had done, we've already talked about the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Is it seems like all the parties involved in this Middle East have been duplicitous, or they were just double dealing with each other all the time. And that's really the main problem of how the Middle East of today got developed, because people had their own agendas, but no one was really being honest with each other. And the true agendas of what people wanted were kept secret. And I think Michael Korda, whether he intended to do this or not, in this chapter, he lets us see how serious this double dealing really was. And, I mean, it's still going on today. There's no doubt in my mind this double dealing is still going on today. I mean, if we just look at the political situation in America, it's really gotten very bad. And again, there's a lot of people who are just hiding the truth and they're lying. And the people who are telling the truth are accused of lying, and the people who are lying are saying they're telling the truth. And so you know, deceit is such a big part of the destruction going on in this world. It's just unimaginable. So what I want to do to start out today's program, let's go back to page 297. And what I want to do is I want to just review what Lawrence's plan was. And we have to just kind of keep this in our minds. And I'm going to read to you from the very middle of this page. It says, on his arrival in Cairo on July 10, 1917, after the capture of Aqaba, Lawrence told Clayton, his nominal superior officer, that there was much more he could do if Clayton thought I had earned the right to be my own master. And so if you look at Lawrence's life, that's the beginning of his duplicity. He was just as double-dealing. How about if we say it that way? He was just as double-dealing as everybody else in the Middle East. But he did want to be his own master. He wanted to do his own thing. And, of course, he did sketch his own plan, to help the Arabs. And essentially, he wanted to disrupt the Turkish railway system from Homs and Hama, north of Damascus, to Mon in the south, and to threaten vital railway lines and junctions deep inside Lebanon and Palestine, throwing Turkish communications into confusion and perhaps even seizing Damascus. Now, seizing Damascus is what he really, kept secret, and that was really the very, the heart of his plan, is he wanted to have the Arabs get a hold of Damascus. They could declare the Arab state, and they could keep the French out and the British out of, developing more colonial rule. Now, the thing is, he didn't tell everybody all of that. Now, with his usual quick mind, Lawrence had guessed that Allenby's intention was to advance from El Arish to Jerusalem. Though, now listen to this, he could not have known that David Lloyd George, on sending Allenby out to replace General Murray, had said, and this is a quote from David Lloyd George, that he wanted Jerusalem as a Christmas present for the British people. So this was concealed from Lawrence, but Lawrence was smart enough to figure out that they did want to take Jerusalem. Now, Allenby was determined to give Lloyd George what he wanted and instantly saw the advantage of using the Arabs to disrupt Turkish communications and supply lines rather than to have them try to take Medina and probably fail again. If you remember, they tried to take Medina before. They could not take it again. And the British were losing so many battles there, they didn't want to have any more going on that way, going that badly. So again, that was Lawrence's plan. Remember that. He wanted to disrupt the Turkish railway. He wanted to throw Turkish communications into confusion. He wanted to stop their supply lines. And perhaps he could seize Damascus, which was, again, duplicity on his part. And he wanted to give the Arabs what they wanted. Now, let's look at Allenby's plan. Again, now just look at it this way. Allenby knew all along that he was going to try and take Jerusalem. And he saw this thing, this plan, or this the strategy of Lawrence, he saw that is the way to help himself. And again, they did not want to try and take Medina again, but they wanted to just go ahead and disrupt the Turks. Now, what Allenby really understood, and again, Corder brings this out really well, is Allenby knew that if there was an enterprising Turkish or German commander, remember, there was a few really good ones. The British had originally thought the Turks, couldn't fight their way out of a paper bag, but they soon learned that that wasn't true. And Allenby knew that to accomplish what he needed to accomplish, a good Turkish or a German commander could assemble a force large enough to strike westward against Allenby. And so essentially, when he got a hold of Lawrence's plan, Lawrence and his Arab troops would kind of fill in the vacuum. And remember, there was just a lot of empty space there. And, of course, what he thought is, well, if Lawrence can go ahead and get his Arab troops together, they'll kind of fill the vacuum of that empty space in the desert. And the thing is, they would keep the Turks occupied. And then, of course, Allenby felt that he could go ahead and move quicker to Jerusalem and take it. And, of course, that's what David Lloyd George wanted as well. Now, I want to just read to you a little bit from page 298. And here, Lawrence and Allenby are supposedly on the same side. But again, what's interesting is he was actually more interested in helping David Lloyd George. And so let me just read to you at the very top of the page. This is page 298, and it says, Faisal's forces, whatever they might be, and he's talking about Faisal's forces working with Lawrence. He said that both Faisal and Lawrence were often wildly optimistic about numbers. Now, Allenby understood that. But the thing is Allenby considered them an extension of his right flank, and if they were in the desert and they were stirring up all this trouble, then they would protect him. Now, here's what's interesting, and again, here's a quote from this page, page 298. It says, Allenby did not necessarily expect Lawrence to succeed with these ambitious plans, but so long as Lawrence and the Arabs were active on his right and cut Turkish telegraph wires, he would be content. The Turks, who were engaged in patrolling or repairing the single-line railway to the Medina, defending Medina and manned against Arab raiders from the desert, would be pinned down, unable to be moved quickly to threaten his right flank, and for all practical purposes in the battle to come, they might as well not exist. And so in some ways, here Allenby is just going to be using Lawrence, but in some ways, here the British underestimated Faisal and Lawrence as well. And, Aqaba should have taught them that. And so here's duplicity on Allenby's part, duplicity on Lloyd George's part. And this was the underpinnings of everything that was going on in the Middle East. And of course, as we go through the program, I'm going to show you it gets just kind of spread everywhere. Notice that when Allenby gave Lawrence the right to go ahead and move on with his plans, it says that, well, Lawrence, he just jumped to it. He took advantage of it. Here's what Korda says again, this is on page 298. It says, Lawrence moved fast to capitalize on his newfound position. He secured Allenby's permission to transfer his base from faraway Wej to Aqaba, which was no easy task because it involved securing Hussein's agreement to place Faisal and his Arab forces under Allenby's command, as well as squaring General Wingate in Khartoum and drawing on the stores at Rabah that had been intended for Abdullah's use. And so here the thing is it's kind of like they're all playing chess with each other and they're all trying to win. And, you really should never have underestimated Lawrence and his ability to move and his ability to get things done. Now, this is going to bring in a kind of another, let's say, another, oh, I don't know, screwdriver in the ringer, I guess, or, another nut is going to come off the bolt. But anyway, Lawrence acted very quickly. And but the problem is he was going to have to go and get Hussein's, this is King Hussein or the father's permission to have Faisal come under Allenby. And, that was not going to be easy. That was going to be a challenge. And so what this really brings up is here you have the British are duplicitous, and in a minute we'll talk about the French were duplicitous. They didn't necessarily tell Lawrence everything. Lawrence didn't necessarily tell them everything. But then you had to start dealing with the Arabs, who could also be very duplicitous. And so you wonder, they accomplished as much as they did. And so essentially what Korda brings out now is that Lawrence is probably the only one that could get to could really get to Hussein and get him to give permission, you know, to have his son Faisal under, you know, the control of the British, and because they didn't trust the British, they didn't trust the French. Now here's the point is, and we've talked about this in other programs where, you know, the British weren't even in agreement among themselves how to handle the Middle East. Well, essentially, King Faisal, or the, you know, Sharif Faisal, Hussein, who is the father, Sharif Hussein, you know, Faisal's father, Abdullah's father. I mean, even the sons kind of had their own agendas. And here's what Corder says. He said, you know, he's talking about the sons. He says, the shifting relationship between Sharif Hussein's sons, consistent only in their obedience to their stern father's authority, required a constant careful study of the Hashemite family and its moods, a subject on which Lawrence was already an expert. And so the thing is Lawrence, even as we'll see, he just came to believe that the British were like, they couldn't understand how to deal with the Arabs, but he did. And, you know, Lawrence really did study the family. Remember, he had been on the ground with the Arabic peoples since a young man. And, you know, he could read them, he could understand them. But even the sons couldn't get along. They couldn't necessarily decide among themselves. Now, they were very obedient to their father, but that's about it. Now, Lawrence actually loved dealing with the Arabs because he could use them to get back at the French. And this is what Corder also brings out. So notice that this is in that same paragraph. It's like the third paragraph on this page. It said, it also involves something he did not regret. Further friction with the French, who wanted to see the Arab army tied up trying to take Medina, as opposed to seeing it in a position to advance into Syria. So here the French were dealing their own, duplicity in the area because they wanted Syria. And I think, you know, we've talked about that before. And so the point is, it's just amazing how Corder brings this all out. And like I said, whether he intended to or not, when I read it, this is what I read. How could they get anything done? And, you know, no wonder the Middle East can be a mess today. But Lawrence, like I said, was a player just as much as the other people were. Now, Corder has a chance to bring out here that, Lawrence did have this ability to win people over to his side. And if he was going to go visit, Sharif Hussein, someone was going to have to take over Aqaba. And they did call upon Lieutenant Colonel Pierce Charles Joyce to take command of Aqaba. And I don't know if we did talk about this before or not, but if you remember early on, there's a lot of the British military just did not like Lawrence because of his unmilitary appearance. And I do think if you see that movie with Peter O'Toole, they did a good job of showing how bad his military dress was. But anyway, it turns out that Lieutenant Colonel, actually began to really appreciate Lawrence because he was so ambitious, and he was able to accomplish things. And so actually they had become great friends. And by this time, actually Lawrence agreed that he should be able to take over Aqaba and command it while he was gone. And that says a lot about Lawrence and how all of a sudden his influence just grew, where people were getting his counsel. Well, should we put Charles Joyce in there? And of course, Lawrence said he agreed to it. Now, I just want to read you the top of page 299. It says, on paper, Joyce was Lawrence's commander, but in fact, he was the firmly planted anchor to Lawrence's ambitious schemes. A broad, 6-foot-tall pillar of strength, common sense, and knowledge of how to get things done by the book, and more important, despite the book, in the army. And so it's a lot of like Allenby. If you remember back to our last program, is Allenby gave Lawrence his space, let him be master of his own life, But he stood in Lawrence's shadow, and it just seems like the same way that here Joyce was willing to, kind of be, on the side with Lawrence, let Lawrence, maybe take the limelight. Now we'll come to see that the Arabs didn't necessarily agree with that tactic when it comes to Lawrence. But anyway, Lawrence went ahead and he was sent off. And now we come to Sharif Hussein, and here remember now the Arab revolt has already started, and one of the things they had asked Hussein is not to declare himself king, but he went ahead against British wishes and he declared himself king of the Hejaz in 1916, and the British were really concerned what that would do with Ibn Saud. Remember, Ibn Saud is, we get the nation Saudi Arabia from Ibn Saud. So essentially, the Arabs weren't getting along either. And when Sharif Hussein, I don't mean to say insane, but King Hussein declared himself king, that really threw another wrench in the ring, let's say, and that didn't really help the situation. But here's what Korda says about Lawrence, and I want you to be able to see his influence even during all of this. Notice this is middle of page 299. It says Lawrence boarded the HMS Dufferin, which had been placed at his disposal, and stopped for one day in the Wedge. There, the RFC provided an airplane to fly him 100 miles inland to Jeddah, a little palm garden where Faisal and Joyce were encamped. It is a mark of Lawrence's new status that naval ships and aircraft were now his for the asking. At Jeddah, comfortable under the palms, he discussed with Faisal the best way of approaching his father and also a new factor in the Arab army. Jafar Pasha, a Baghdadi who was a former Turkish officer, had become Faisal's chief of staff and had also organized a number of Arab prisoners of war from the Turkish army into a uniformed group, quite separate from the Bedouin tribesmen who made up the bulk of Faisal's forces. Jafar's regulars were professional soldiers, not irregulars, and while their number was still small, they would play an increasingly important role in the Arab army. And so the point is, look at Lawrence. I mean, here he is. He's really working with the Arabic peoples on a different level than even the British. And, of course, the British allowed it to happen because they knew he could do it. And it is kind of fascinating, this whole situation. Now, the meeting with King Hussein. And remember that I'm talking about Sharif Hussein. Lawrence really did not like this guy, and actually really had trouble with him. And here's how Lawrence described him, and this is a quote. It says he saw King Hussein as an obstinate, narrow-minded, suspicious character, little likely to sacrifice his vanity to forward a unity of control. And Lawrence had a way with words that sometimes came back to really hurt him. But the British didn't like him either, and they were just more than willing to have Lawrence go and try and work with him. And this is what Korda says in the book. He said, this was putting it mildly, almost all the British, while they admired him as a splendid old gentleman, found Hussein difficult to deal with, unreasonable, intolerably long-winded, and vain. And now, the only man, if you want to know the truth, the only man, or the only British man that could get along with Sharif Hussein or King Hussein was Ronald Storrs. Remember, Ronald Storrs was a great friend of Lawrence's, and Hussein would call him Ya Ibni, or my son, or Ya Azizi, or my dear. And so, when it gets down to brass tacks here, we're actually going to see that Lawrence really didn't have as much pull with King Hussein as people thought he would. Well, that's all we have time for today's program. Next time, we'll continue our discussion of chapter 1917, The Uncrowned King of Arabia. Now, we are coming to the conclusion of this series pretty quickly. But remember, for this current series of programs, we're using Michael Korda's book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. You can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can also find a used copy of the book at ABEbooks.com. And of course, if you're just tuning in now, you could also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. And I just wanted everyone to realize we are back online with JB Literature 1. I have a technical assistant helping me with posting. We'll be posting nearly every day, so you want to check that out. Also, you can follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.